Disc 29.
Johnson, of course, was lobbying himself, harder than anyone, Oltorff says, as well as mapping strategy and directing the overall campaign. Every evening, after the majority leader had finished his work on the Senate floor, Connally would be waiting for him in 231 to give him what Oltorff calls daily reports. Then Connally would have dinner with Oltorff, who would relay the reports to Herman Brown in Houston. And Johnson was not lobbying only in his office. In obtaining the necessary votes from the other side of the aisle, he needed more than Eisenhower's support. So he was deepening his alliance with the Republican senator who, as chairman of the GOP Policy Committee and ranking GOP member of the Appropriations Committee, held power over bills vital to GOP senators. The glue for part of that alliance was social. He had Stiles Bridges down to Huntland's during the natural gas fight, Oltorff recalls. Part was philosophical. To Bridges, of course, any assault on business had to be communist-inspired. And part, as always in the Johnson-Bridges relationship, was pragmatic. The $5,000 in cash from Johnson that Bobby Baker carried to New Hampshire for Bridges was only one episode. In either October or November of 1955, Elmer Patman had made a lobbying trip to that state. And in the overall pattern of the Johnson-Bridges relationship, these were minor episodes. The key figures in the major episodes were Connally and Clark. Asked why Bridges would not only support the natural gas bill himself, but would also bring the support of other Republican senators, Connally replied, "The reason was money." He said he did not recall the amount involved, but that it was large. "I told you I carried inordinate amounts of cash," he said. Asked the reason for Bridges' support, Clark smiled and rubbed together his thumb and index finger in the gesture that means money. Asked how much money, Clark said he could no longer recall, but asked if it might have been about $5,000, he laughed. "It would have been many times 5,000," he said. Stiles Bridges was no piker. Nor was such lobbying confined to New Hampshire. Patman sent an emissary, John Neff, to pay visits to several Republican senators in the Midwest. Whatever terrain he picked for his battle, Lyndon Johnson fought well. "I was worried," Claude Wilde recalls. "It," natural gas deregulation, "was not a popular issue. If you don't have a good champion there, well, it's awful easy for a senator to vote against it." But, Wilde says, natural gas had a real champion, not Rayburn. "I doubt he had any impression of the stakes. He had no idea what money was. But Johnson, in Lyndon we really had one," says Oltorff. "He, Johnson, got Bridges. Johnson really wanted him involved, and he got him involved." Hardly had the Senate convened on January 3rd when Johnson knew he had enough Republican votes to win. The captain had devised a devastatingly effective strategy. Northern newspapers and magazines were already seething with outrage. The New York Times called the bill wrong, socially, economically, and politically. The Nation called it a gouge, saying that the producers are convinced they will get away with it because of their power over Congress, and reminding its readers that oil interests helped to finance McCarthy's 4-year anti-democratic crusade. The New Republic said that the contention that natural gas ought to sell in a free market, like coal or wheat, loses some force when one notes that buyers of natural gas can never buy in a free market. Johnson kept debate on the Senate floor from turning the temperature up any higher. Proclaiming repeatedly that he would not ram the bill through, that of course there must be full debate on so important a measure, Johnson gave the Northerners all the time they wanted, a full month, with the vote scheduled for February 6th. His only request, he said, was that the debate be gentlemanly. What he didn't give them was arguments or opposition or even an audience, anything that would furnish grist for the journalistic mill. When liberal opponents of the bill were speaking, there were few comments or even questions from the bill's supporters. There were, in fact, few supporters. Johnson had told them to stay away from the chamber. By thus arranging for the liberals to be ignored rather than answered, he had ensured that their speeches received less attention than would have been the case had there been controversy, news-making controversy, on the floor. And since many liberals had a natural reluctance to sit at their desks listening to someone else give a long speech, and they had no leader strong enough to ensure that they stayed on the floor anyway, liberals often found themselves speaking to a very small audience indeed. On January 25th, for example, Paul Douglas took the floor for a long, carefully researched speech against the Harris-Fulbright bill. There were only two other senators present, the presiding officer and Frank Carlson of Kansas. The presiding officer signaled to Carlson to take the chair, and, stepping down from the dais, left the chamber himself. That left Senator Douglas talking to four rows of desks, in which there was not a single senator present, Frederick Hoffman wrote. In the press gallery, reporters were busy interviewing each other on the question of whether anybody remembered seeing a senator speaking to nobody at all. Even the oldest correspondent couldn't remember a time when at least two or three senators weren't on the floor. Unwilling to blame themselves for the situation, which of course could have been at least partially improved had they simply been willing to sacrifice a little time to listen to one another speak, the liberals blamed Johnson. For the sake of appearances, it would seem that Senator Lyndon Johnson, who cleverly stage-managed this puppet show, would have arranged for more senators to attend to make it look good from the galleries, Thomas Stokes said. As it was, Stokes said, the farce gives itself away. Too slick was his careful arrangement of full debate. The scene in the Senate reflecting the apathy and cynicism of the elected servants carries me back to the 1920s when big money was moving the pawns about here in Washington. But the strategy worked. While some of the arguments against the bill were eloquent, the concentrated power of the great oil companies, wielded today to influence the decision of national government by contributions to both parties in many parts of the United States, is a menace to the proper functioning of free government within this country, Hennings said. The arguments were delivered before galleries that were almost as empty as the floor. Writing angrily that perhaps the most cynical aspect of Johnson's management of the issue was his pious decree that the debate must be gentlemanly, Doris Fleeson had to admit that the decree, of course, had the effect of dampening tension and excitement, emotions that do sometimes communicate themselves to the Senate and the public and affect the outcome of debate. The Washington Post could only observe helplessly that because senators have stayed away from the Senate in droves, the arguments on the floor have attracted far less attention than they deserved. Never in the many years I have covered Washington have I seen such a skillful job of backstage manipulation, Drew Pearson had to confess. So completely did Johnson feel he had the situation under control that in the middle of the debate he left for a brief vacation in Florida on a Brown and Root plane. And then, without warning, the natural gas bill of 1956 became a moral issue. On Friday, February 3rd, as the Senate was droning toward the weekend recess before the scheduled Monday vote on the measure, Senator Francis Case of South Dakota suddenly rose at his desk and announced that a lobbyist for a natural gas company had come to his campaign headquarters in Sioux Falls and left an envelope to be given to him, an envelope containing $100 bills, 25 of them, in fact. He had been planning to vote for the bill, Case said. The principle of maintaining free enterprise appeals to me, but the payment, which would be the largest single contribution I could remember for any campaign of mine, reminded him of Hennings's warning that the oil company's money power is a menace to the proper functioning of free government. I object, Case said, to doing something so valuable to those interested in natural gas that they advance huge sums of money as a down payment, so to speak, on the profits they expect to harvest. Since the bill evidently has prospects of unusual monetary profit to some, and with that profit would go the means for a continuing effort to influence the course of government for private gain, I must vote against it. Suddenly, the press had all the grist it needed. Senator tells of bribe attempt, headlines blared. Summoning Gulf Oil's chief lobbyist, David Searles, to his Mayflower suite, Ed Clark gave him some very serious advice. You are in the wrong place today. I wouldn't be in Washington today. There would almost certainly be an investigation of Case's charge, Clark said, and that investigation might easily expand to include other contributions. If Searles was in Washington, it would be easy to serve a subpoena on him. And if you ever get called to testify, you're going to be in a position where you have to tell the truth or lie. And if you lie, you're going to be in danger of perjury. If it were me, I would leave today. Whether or not Searles himself followed Clark's advice is not known, but it was followed by so many others that the Mayflower found itself with an unexpectedly high number of vacant rooms that Friday evening. All that afternoon, the private planes had been taking off from National Airport, heading southwest. John Connolly was not nearly as tough as Clark, and he was far more immediately threatened by Case's bombshell. Although the senator had not yet named the lobbyist who had offered him the cash, saying he wanted to do so not on the Senate floor but to some properly constituted authority, such as the FBI or a Senate committee, Connolly knew that it was John Neff, a lobbyist for Keck's Superior Oil Company, and that the cash had come from Elmer Patman and the General Gas Committee, whose lobbying operations Connolly was directing. And Connolly didn't move as fast as Clark, either. When Tommy Corcoran rushed into Connolly's suite at the Mayflower, he found him white-faced, all the self-assurance gone in an instant. For an entire day, he sat paralyzed, one of his biographers, James Reston Jr., was to write. Then he, too, left town. As Reston says, "The widely held rumor was that Lyndon Johnson had spirited his friend out of Washington for fear that Connolly would be questioned and then implicated and indicted in the scandal." In his own memoir, Connolly says, in an attempt at exculpation that is unintentionally revealing, "No attempt had been made to bribe anyone. A contribution that would have been given routinely was handled clumsily, with atrocious timing. But this was unfortunately one of the quirks of character of people who lived and died in an industry where fortunes were made and lost almost overnight. Many oil men of that period carried with them staggering amounts of cash, and they treated it as though they were tossing around chips in a Las Vegas casino." Lyndon Johnson wasn't paralyzed. His instant reaction was to rage at Case. "I think we ought to investigate the morals of some people in South Dakota for bringing this up," he said, and to try to make him seem like a guilty party in the matter. First, he tried to impugn Case's veracity by casting doubt on the truth of the story, saying, in a statement with no basis in fact, that it was based upon a vague recollection of a lady clerk. The next day he said, "Thus far, Senator Case has declined to reveal the name of the man who left the money. Unless the senator from South Dakota voluntarily divulges the name of the fellow, and the impropriety, if any, the Senate is going to investigate." Then, when Case gave Neff's name, together with the envelope and the $2,500 bills, to the FBI, Johnson switched to impugning Case's motives. Ignoring the fact that Case had been a supporter of the natural gas bill, and the fact that he had reported the contribution as soon as he realized it was connected with the bill, Johnson told reporters that he considered the timing of Case's revelation, so close to the date of the vote, a deliberate attempt to sabotage the measure, an attempt he said would not succeed. When several senators urged that the vote be delayed until, as Mike Mansfield put it, a complete and thorough investigation could ascertain whether other senators had received similar offers, Johnson said there would be no delay. The vote, he said, would be held on Monday as scheduled. On Monday, on a packed Senate floor, several senators on both sides of the aisle called for a delay until, as Republican Potter of Michigan put it, it could be determined whether Neff's approach to Case had been an isolated instance, or just a small part of the big overall effort of certain people to influence the passage of this bill. But the majority leader was having none of it. "The Senate of the United States can ill afford to prostrate itself before phantoms," he said. "This is what we would be doing if we delayed the vote now at hand." When the clerk called the roll, the only senator who changed his vote because of the uproar over the Case contribution was Case, who voted against it. Every other senator voted as Johnson's tally sheet showed he was going to vote, and while the Democrats voted against the bill 24-22, Republicans supported it by a 31-14 margin. The Senate, casting aside suggestions that it was voting under a cloud of suspicion, passed the natural gas bill tonight, 53-38, John Morris reported in the New York Times. All signs indicate that President Eisenhower will sign it into law. The calls for an investigation did not die away, however. In a coincidence that Johnson viewed as unfortunate, the Rules Committee had the previous year appointed a 3-member subcommittee to look into the broad question of campaign financing. Not only was it the obvious body to conduct the investigation, but its chairman was Missouri's Hennings, who, facing a re-election campaign in November, had vowed to stop drinking, had in fact kept that vow for some months, and was therefore once again a dynamic and effective senator, and who, as a former district attorney, knew how to investigate. Moreover, the other Democratic member was the lamentably independent Albert Gore. Surrounded by reporters in the lobby outside the Senate chamber, Hennings said his subcommittee would begin the very next morning a thorough and complete look into the case matter and every other damn matter in connection with it, and get at the big boys if we can. Lyndon Johnson could not allow such an investigation. The big boys in question were his big boys, Herman and George and Sid and Clint, and the other oil men with whose lobbying efforts he had been so closely connected. They were Ed Clark and John Connolly, who had worked right out of his office. Any thorough and complete investigation could hardly help turning up his name. It had to be stopped. And he stopped it. On the next day, Tuesday, February 8, 1956, a day of fast-paced and often brutal maneuvering in the Capitol and the Senate office building. He was not the only senator who wanted it stopped, of course. Some of his colleagues had personal reasons. What Mr. Case did was to raise in the Senate the whisper, "oil money," William White wrote. Campaign financing was a sensitive issue with many senators, and no aspect of such financing was more sensitive than oil money. In recent years, the issues, in which there were truly vast sums of money involved, have concerned the oil and gas lobby. Who knew how many senators' names might be blackened in a probe of oil money? Others feared a blackening not only of themselves, but of what Russell Baker described as the entire political structure supporting them. There was a growing uneasiness in the Senate about having itself subjected to a tough investigation on this most delicate of issues, Baker said. A growing doubt as to whether the voting public could stomach the facts of political life. And the mere fact of such an investigation might tarnish the Senate's image. Nothing disturbs the Senate type more than evidence that the Senate may be losing the respect of the country, White wrote. For all these reasons, James Reston Sr. said, if there is anything that exceeds the need for a fundamental investigation and revision of the present system of financing campaigns, it is the unwillingness of many senators to encourage such an investigation. But Johnson was the senator most involved, and he was the senator who played the leading role in stopping the investigation. Pleading with Hennings to restrict his subcommittee's investigation to the single contribution, Johnson pulled out all the stops. The agitation over the natural gas fight was causing his heart to act up again, he said. The doctor was even threatening to put him back on Digitalis. I felt as though I were being cast in the role of his murderer, a shaken Hennings would tell a friend the next morning. And when Hennings nonetheless tried to stand his ground, he abruptly found it opening beneath his feet. As soon as the Senate convened on Tuesday, Johnson and Noland, in a move which Johnson devised and to which Noland acquiesced, jointly introduced a resolution, which passed unanimously without discussion, establishing a Select Committee for Contribution Investigation. Its 4 members were Democrats Walter George and Carl Hayden, and Republicans Edward Thigh of Minnesota and Stiles Bridges. The Select Committee's mandate was as narrow as was implied by the lack of any plural in its title. The resolution empowered it to investigate the circumstances surrounding the alleged improper contribution to Case, and no other contribution. Included in the resolution was a budget, $10,000, adequate only for so narrow an inquiry. And in the committee's first meeting, held in Vice President Nixon's office, steps were taken to make sure that its investigation of that contribution would be the only investigation of that contribution. Hennings had telephoned Senator Case that Tuesday morning to invite him to testify at 2 o'clock that afternoon before his campaign finance subcommittee, and Case had agreed to do so. Johnson, learning of this, moved fast, with Nixon's help. In a formal ruling which the New York Times said was without known example in the Senate, Nixon awarded the Select Committee exclusive jurisdiction over the case investigation. A letter, hastily typed for Walter George's signature and delivered to Case at 1:40, just 20 minutes before he was to appear before the Hennings subcommittee, summoned him to testify before the Select Committee on Friday. The letter notified him of Nixon's ruling and said that, therefore, they, the Select Committee, respectfully request that you appear before no other committee prior to that time. The written request was reinforced by an oral communication described by Arthur Kroc. Mr. George just sent word to Mr. Case that at 2 o'clock he was to come to the Vice President's room, where Mr. George's Select Committee was to assemble, and Mr. Case was to go nowhere else. And when Case arrived, he was told by George that his first public testimony had better be to the Select Committee. He was not requesting Case to testify before the committee first, Walter George said. He was directing him to do so. While Senator George was thus taking steps to keep the subcommittee from holding its hearing, Senator Johnson was taking his own steps, asking Senator Hennings to come to see him in his office, and then trying to persuade him at length to leave the investigation to the George Committee. Johnson had wanted to see Hennings alone, but the Missourian had brought Gore along, and the three men were arguing heatedly when Gore told Hennings, "Let's go, it's after 2 o'clock, and Case was scheduled to meet with us at 2. "Go ahead," Johnson said angrily. "I didn't invite you here." The two senators went to the subcommittee room, but Case was not there. When the South Dakota senator finally did appear, he was carrying George's letter, which he read to the subcommittee to explain why he couldn't testify before it. And then Hennings and Gore were summoned to a hastily called closed meeting of their subcommittee's Parent Rules Committee. And although they angrily protested the unprecedented Johnson-Noland attempt to gag a senator, the rest of the committee said that, in view of Nixon's ruling, the George Committee had exclusive jurisdiction over the case affair. Once again, all other arguments had faded before what Arthur Kroc called Mr. George's unique prestige. In a column bearing the accurate headline, "It Doesn't Pay to Challenge Mr. George," Kroc wrote that, "The old man doesn't hold with argument if he says a thing is so, or is to be done thus and thus. He doesn't hold with it even if he is acting in his individual capacity, which is pretty powerful. And that goes double when Mr. George has been deputized by the Senate leaders of both parties, and another senator tries to put on the same show in another tent." The Select Committee tried to keep the focus on the Case contribution and on Case's motives for disclosing it, and on the timing of the disclosure. Questioning the senator for 4 hours, committee counsel Charles W. Stedman bored in like a prosecuting attorney, the New York Times reported, so that Case was cast somewhat in the role of a defendant. Nonetheless, it was impossible to avoid calling the man who had made the contribution and asking where he had gotten the money, and as soon as Neff began to testify, the names of more senators began to surface. Neff testified that he had gotten the $2,500 from Elmer Patman, and then Patman had to be called, and he testified that he had gotten it from Howard Keck. Asked the nature of his connection with Patman and Keck, Neff testified that he had been employed by Keck's Superior Oil Company to represent it not only in South Dakota, but in Nebraska as well. The name of an old friend in Nebraska, Donald R. Ross, the U.S. attorney, came up, and Ross was questioned by the Justice Department. He was shortly to resign, but before he did, he stated that Neff had offered him $5,000 after receiving assurance that both of Nebraska's senators, Republicans Carl Curtis and Roman Hruska, would vote for the natural gas bill, as in fact both of them had. And, Ross added, Neff had offered to make additional contributions to Nebraska's Republican State Finance Committee. Then the chairman of that committee, Joseph Wishart, revealed that Neff had pulled out this handful of money, had peeled off $2,500 and given it to him for the committee, and had said he wanted to make additional donations. And Ross also added that Neff had said his employers wanted to make contributions in other states where the people were not unfriendly to the natural gas industry. He had mentioned trying to get in contact with somebody in Montana, and had mentioned that he had also made trips to Wyoming and Iowa, and in Iowa had spoken to GOP National Committeeman Robert K. Goodwin. It was impossible to avoid calling Goodwin, and he testified that Neff had indeed visited him, had told him that he had $2,500 to contribute to Senator Hickenlooper's campaign, and had offered to leave $1,000 with him pending the time when he could see Senator Hickenlooper. Goodwin said he had turned both offers down because they seemed like a down payment on a purchase. And then there was a development which made it seem likely that the names of other senators might surface. Goodwin said that when Neff had visited him, he had apparently inadvertently left behind a list of the 96 senators. Next to each name was written for, doubtful, or against, and against the names of 10 of the 15 doubtful senators, a check mark had been made. It became obvious that more money might be involved than the amounts that had been mentioned. Testifying before the committee, Keck said that he did not consider $2,500 a substantial contribution. He said he could not say what other senators had received contributions, substantial or not, because he did not keep records. It became obvious that contributions were mostly in cash. Just as there had been an envelope with $2,500 bills intended for Case, the money offered to Wishart had been in hundreds and in an envelope. Booth Mooney sat in on every hearing of the George Committee on Johnson's orders and gave him a detailed report at the end of each day's session, he was to recall. He was worried, more deeply than I had ever seen him, that his name or John Connolly's would come up in the course of the investigation. But somehow, Mooney wrote, that did not happen, despite the fact that Connolly had worked closely with Patman. Nor was that the only subject unexplored. Neff had testified that he had contributed to the personal campaign fund of no senator except Senator Case since last October. But, as the New York Times put it, he was not asked to explain the qualification personal campaign fund, and no attempt was made to determine whether he had made any contributions before last October. Editorials demanded that the Select Committee broaden its probe. ADA Chairman Rao accused it of merely scratching the surface of this scandalous incident. Only the most naive would think that this is all the money involved, the New York Times said. Why was Case singled out? Or was the benevolence one of many? Arthur Kroc asked. The questions call for answers. But Senator George said, personally, I see no need for any further inquiry. The committee's hearings were adjourned on March 5th. Noting that it was limited in its scope and confined in its authority by the express direction of the Senate to the Case contribution, its report, issued on April 7th, kept within these limited confines. Commenting that it left much unsaid, the Washington Post stated that its strangest deficiency lies in its failure to commend Senator Francis Case for his courageous exposure of what the gas bill lobbyists were up to. At the committee's hearings, it sometimes appeared that Senator Case was the culprit rather than the people who tried to influence his vote by contributing $2,500. As for the other senators whose names had come up in the hearing, the committee's report mentioned them only in passing. It assailed Neff, Patman, and Keck and said it was turning the transcript of the hearings over to the Justice Department to determine if any statutes had been violated. Neff and Patman were later indicted for failure to register under the Lobbying Act, and both men pled guilty, thereby avoiding a trial in which other names might have been mentioned. They were each given a 1-year suspended jail sentence and fined a token, a rather whimsical token, $2,500. And, saying that the Federal Lobbying Act and the Federal Corrupt Practices Act were too vague and loosely defined, it contained the usual recommendations that Congress make a thorough and complete study of campaign financing laws. The next episode in the natural gas fight took place, on February 17th, not on Capitol Hill, but in the White House. President Eisenhower numbered many titans of the oil industry among his friends. He was as indebted to the industry for past campaign contributions as was Johnson. And as he prepared for his re-election campaign, he was as hopeful of future contributions. He was philosophically committed to reducing, not increasing, government regulation of industry in general, and he was particularly committed to reduction in the case of this industry, for he had become persuaded of the validity of the argument that oil and natural gas exploration entailed great risk, and high profits were therefore necessary to encourage exploration. But to Eisenhower, all those considerations were invalidated by the circumstances surrounding the passage of the Natural Gas Act. "There is a great stench around the passing of the bill," he wrote in his diary. "It is the kind of thing that makes American politics a dreary and frustrating experience for anyone who has any regard for moral and ethical standards." Announcing that he approved the bill's basic objectives, but that because of the arrogant lobbying efforts on its behalf, he could not sign it without creating doubt among the American people concerning the integrity of governmental processes, he vetoed it. Taking into account his approval of the bill's objectives, as well as the fact that the Republican Party was counting on millions in contributions from the oil industry for the coming campaign, the veto was an act of some courage, Eisenhower's biographer Stephen Ambrose has written. Lyndon Johnson issued a statement which said, "Since the president himself has regarded this bill as meritorious, his veto is difficult to understand." Narrow though Johnson had kept the Select Committee investigation, he hadn't kept it narrow enough to accomplish his purposes. Despite his efforts, enough hints of the vastness of the oil industry's lobbying efforts had emerged to fuel indignation over the Senate's failure to police itself. And in editorials in major newspapers in every section of the country except the Southwest, the indignation was laid at the door of the senator at which it belonged. The Denver Post, for example, told its readers that it was Lyndon Johnson's slippery leadership of the oil bloc that has blunted one of his party's sharpest campaign weapons. He's helped turn what had the makings of a crusade against giveaways into a Hollywood production interspersed with drawling commercials for Colonel Johnson's banana oil. The plunderbund was Mr. Johnson's victory. Demands for a full investigation escalated. The honor and dignity of the Senate require that it expose every aspect of the efforts of the gas lobby to influence the vote through political contributions, both those made recently and those made before the bill was under active consideration, the Washington Post said. Calling Senator George's inquiry unsatisfactory, the New York Times said, "There is every reason for a much fuller investigation. Even seasoned veterans of legislative battles have been astounded at the pressures brought to bear." And the indignation was summarized, eloquently, by a journalist who was rising to rare respect and influence in the Capitol. Ever since Francis Case made his statement, James Reston Sr. wrote on February 20th, "This city has been full of the most disturbing rumors, not only that this kind of money is passed around by wealthy organizations that stand to gain by the enactment of certain legislation, but that the leadership of the Senate is in cahoots to conceal the facts. The immediate question is whether the majority and minority leaders are going to use their power and influence to correct the evils they know to exist, or whether they are going to try to conceal them and allow the rumors of widespread misconduct to stain the reputation of what they are fond of referring to as the world's greatest legislative body." Given Johnson's plans for an imminent entrance onto the national stage, there was little alternative to authorizing a more complete investigation, and one was authorized, with appropriate fanfare. The day after the Reston column appeared, the majority leader took the floor, declaring that he had been unfairly, unjustly, and almost unmercifully portrayed as blocking a Senate inquiry. He said his whole purpose from the start of the controversy had been to have a full inquiry and not one confined to the Case contribution. "You senators and reporters, you better saddle your horse and put on your spurs if you're going to keep up with Johnson on the flag mother and corruption," he said. Then he introduced a resolution, endorsed by Noland and quickly passed, to create a new special committee that would conduct, he promised, a far-reaching and thorough investigation dedicated to uncovering any wrongdoing of any kind and accomplishing something constructive. Instead of having the customary Democratic majority, half of its 8 members would be Republican, which, he said, would give no unfair advantage to either party. It would have a full-size, $350,000 budget. It was assumed that its chairman would be Albert Gore, who, as the Times put it, lauding his appointment, has been insisting on an intensive investigation, which he had intended to carry out through the elections subcommittee, but which Johnson had now persuaded him could be better conducted by the special committee. The resolution was greeted enthusiastically by the press. The lobbying investigation promises to become the year's liveliest, Time said. Because of what a complete investigation might reveal, however, there was no alternative to making sure that the special committee did not actually conduct one. That insurance was put in place by naming to the committee, as the senior Republican member, the ubiquitous Bridges, who was totally unabashed by the revelation that he had been one of the senators visited in his home state by Elmer Patman, and hence might himself be a target of the investigation. Gore had assumed that the chairmanship would carry with it the chairman's customary prerogatives, such as the right to appoint the committee's chief counsel and the rest of its staff, and to issue the subpoenas indispensable to any financial investigation. That assumption, however, now proved to be incorrect. At the committee's organizational meeting at which Gore had expected the first order of business to be his election as chairman, Bridges said that since the committee was not a standing but a special committee, the Senate's normal rules for a committee did not apply, and that new rules would have to be made. Speaking for the Republicans, he said, an agreement on the rules would have to come before we proceed to election of any personnel such as chairman. Among the rules the Republicans wanted, Stiles Bridges said, was the right, should a Democrat become chairman, to name the vice chairman, him, Stiles Bridges. And, he said, the vice chairman must have the right to co-sign all subpoenas. Furthermore, if the Democrats selected the chairman, the Republicans must have the right to select the chief counsel, who, he made clear, would be a Republican with whom he was personally comfortable. Since the Democrats did not have a majority in the committee, Gore was helpless. No chairman was elected, no counsel appointed, no subpoenas issued. After one meeting, Newsweek reported, Gore, boiling with rage, ran out of the building and leaped into a cab before newsmen could catch up. Journalists' initial enthusiasm faded before reality. Bipartisanship can play Jekyll Hyde, and the Senate leadership has found a way to frustrate the lobby investigation and still remain on the side of the angels, the New Republic said on March 12th. The new 8-man Senate Committee on Lobbying is headed by the Tennessee crusader Albert Gore, but there will be no great crusade here. Bridges told reporters that his conditions were simply reasonable proposals drawn up to prevent abuses by a runaway committee. The Republicans supported as chairman McClellan, whose Little Rock law firm represented several oil and natural gas companies, and who, as the Times put it, has evinced little sympathy for Senator Gore's objectives. Bridges was elected vice chairman. McClellan moved with deliberation. His first task, he said, on March 10th, was the selection of a staff, which might take some time. That prediction proved accurate. An entire meeting of the committee in mid-April was devoted, the Washington News reported, to discussion of the qualifications of a lady applicant for the job of file clerk. That pace was maintained in all other aspects of the inquiry, which hardly touched on the specific revelations that had been made. Bridges, of course, was never asked about Elmer Patman's visit, or about whether the lobbyist had arrived bearing gifts. Fruska and Curtis were never asked whether they had received the $5,000 contributions. Hickenlooper was never asked about the $1,000 offer that seemed like a down payment on a purchase. John Neff was never asked if any of the 15 senators listed as doubtful on his list had received funds, or about the significance of the check marks by 10 of the names. No attempt was made to learn the full extent of the cash distributed by Keck and the Superior Oil Company, or by any other individual or oil company. Key figure though John Connolly was in the natural gas lobby, closely though he had worked with Patman, he was never called as a witness. The interest of the press slowly but surely waned and faded entirely when the national conventions came to dominate the news that summer. The investigation finally petered out in 1957. Lyndon Johnson was not blamed by the Texas oilmen because the Natural Gas Act of 1956 did not become law. That, of course, was President Eisenhower's fault. Johnson, they felt, had done his job and done it well. The man who was in charge of counting the votes for the natural gas lobby, Claude Wild, Jr., had expected that after the big to-do over the Case contribution, we would lose some votes, perhaps even enough votes so that the bill wouldn't pass. But it passed, Wild says. Only one vote was changed. And he knew who was responsible for such steadfastness. I've got to give Lyndon Johnson a lot of credit, he says. I think that was the finest piece of lobbying work I've ever seen. The money that had been promised to Johnson to finance other senators' campaigns in 1956 and in subsequent years would be delivered. Connally and Jenkins still brought envelopes stuffed with cash to Washington. Searles continued to carry cash himself. And it was after Wilde succeeded Searles in 1959 that, as his first assignment to meet a commitment Searles had made earlier to Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, he made the delivery over a period of months of $50,000 in cash to Mr. Walter Jenkins. And indeed, despite the presidential veto, the oil men had no reason to be dissatisfied with the attitude of the federal government. Even pro-business Fortune magazine found in 1959 that the Federal Power Commission still shirks its statutory responsibility of regulating the price of gas in the interests of the consumer. And in that same year, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous opinion, assailed the commission for having authorized a new high price for gas producers on insufficient evidence. The price of the product, which before 1956 had already risen from its 1946 level of 4 cents per million cubic feet to 10 cents, had in the 3 years since 1956 doubled to more than 21 cents, had risen, in fact, to as much as the market could bear. Fortune said that, in some areas, like New England, natural gas is close to pricing itself out of the market. The industry's revenues were not the $5.3 billion of 1956, but $10.7 billion. The value of the KEX stock was now $40,108,000. And as for Herman and George Brown, they were finding the business so profitable that when, in 1958, an immense new field, the Rain Field, containing more than a trillion cubic feet of natural gas, was brought in Texas, they had Texas Eastern Transmission buy up the entire field. By 1959, the annual profits of Texas Eastern would be $24,527,583, so that the Brown stock was worth $7,113,072. The company, which had been formed 12 years earlier for an initial investment of $143 million, had assets worth more than $1 billion. George Smathers, Johnson's assistant whip during the natural gas battle, was with him from early in the morning until 10:30 at night, and saw that this man who had suffered a heart attack didn't slow up during the entire workday. I don't know how his body stood it. But Johnson not only stood it, but thrived on it. At the conclusion of the natural gas fight, Dr. Kane of the Mayo Clinic wrote Tommy Corcoran, "I have had my fingers crossed during this whole trying period, for I know Lyndon must have been under a terrific strain." But when, on February 20th, Lyndon underwent a complete physical examination at Bethesda, his heart showed no enlargement, and his blood pressure and other vital signs were actually better than they had been in December. To the uninitiated, the first close-up look at Lyndon Johnson was astonishing. A new member of his staff, Nadine Brammer, couldn't believe the abuse he rained on the men and women in his office. "He could be totally charming, a lot of fun. He was always trying to put the make on me. But there was a rotten side to him. There was a lot of personal exhibitionism, a lot of hitting on women. It was like a family atmosphere, and he was the big daddy. He controlled everything. He ruled with fear, like a heavy-duty parent. Fear permeated the whole staff. Lyndon would jump on someone, just make mincemeat of him. Tongue-lashing people. Walter was always on pins and needles. I've seen Walter shake, just literally shake, when Lyndon was asking him questions. Walter was just stripped of any human dignity." Mrs. Brammer was to leave the staff the next year. "I just couldn't understand how they," the staff members, "put up with it." Another new member of the staff wouldn't put up with it. Within a month after Jim Rowe, whom Johnson had recruited so ardently, came on board, he told Johnson he was leaving. He finally agreed to remain until the end of the 1956 session and left then. But no aspect of Johnson was more striking to new staffers than his energy. "He worked us, he worked us," Mrs. Brammer says. "And he worked himself, worked himself. He had made up his mind to be president, and he was demonic in his drive." Lyndon Johnson's program with a heart had contained only one proposal anathema to liberals. Despite scandal and widespread outrage, he had rammed that proposal to passage in the Senate, in a vivid illumination of his power over that body. The fate of the program's other 12 proposals, all liberal proposals, was instructive because it illuminated the purpose for which he was using that power. 5 of those 12 proposals, poll tax elimination, immigration reform, disaster insurance, aid to depressed areas, and tax reduction for the poor, died quiet deaths during the Senate's 1956 session. 5 more, for a federal water conservation program and for federal aid for medical research and for hospital, school, and housing construction, passed in amounts so small or forms so diluted as to make them insignificant. Since President Eisenhower was supporting most of the same programs, the failure of these proposals in a Senate controlled by Johnson was an indication of the extent to which his heart was, or wasn't, truly in the program, of the extent to which the program had been proposed merely to blunt liberal criticism, and of the extent to which his first priority was not to appease liberals, but to avoid antagonizing conservatives. The fate of an 11th proposal was particularly infuriating to liberals. It was a proposal that was actually more part of Eisenhower's program than Johnson's, the bill that became the basis for the interstate highway system. Organized labor had assumed that construction workers on the highway program would be covered by the existing Davis-Bacon Act, which required workers on all federal projects to be paid the prevailing local wage. But Herman Brown, who had started as a road builder and had never lost that image of himself, could not bear to have this most sacred area of free enterprise polluted by the hated unions and their endless gimmies. "He laid down the law to Lyndon on that one," Ed Clark would recall. When, in 1955, Johnson, responding to Brown's edict, had pushed through the Senate an amendment exempting the highway program from Davis-Bacon, allowing senators to vote aye in anonymity by blocking Paul Douglas's attempt to get a roll call vote, as telling to liberals as Johnson's maneuver had been his rationale for it, what Evans and Novak called his quite insincere apprehensions about organized labor. In discussing the bill, they wrote, "He," Johnson, "recalled his own experience on the road gang. Paradoxically, he remembered not his own low pay, but the small profit margin of the contractor, his difficulty in financing new equipment, and his trouble in meeting his tax liabilities." And Johnson's resultant sympathy for the small county contractor colored his attitude toward Davis-Bacon. When the administration-backed highway program reached the Senate floor on May 28th, labor unions were ready for a fight, and a union-backed measure was introduced to have wage rates set by the Secretary of Labor. UAW lobbyist Robert Oliver, who had been on what Evans and Novak call a quiet campaign to soften Johnson's antipathy toward organized labor, warned the majority leader that opposition to the bill when it came to a vote the next day would be disastrous to his future relations with labor, and Johnson found a way to avoid the vote. He had been scheduled to leave for a checkup at the Mayo Clinic at 3 p.m. on the 29th. He moved up his flight to 10 a.m. so he wouldn't be present during the vote, which labor won. As the two journalists put it, Johnson's absence saved him from another attack from the unions, but it scarcely won him their praise. As for the 12th proposal, that too seemed dead as late as July. But when, that month, Johnson began to feel that he had a real chance for the Democratic nomination for president, a softening of liberal antipathy became desirable. And since passage of the last remaining item in the program with a heart would advance both liberal objectives and his own, that item passed, in a form far more liberal than he had at first proposed. In 1955, the House had passed a bill that would have changed the nature of the Social Security system, the first broad change since 1939 in that major New Deal achievement. Previously, Social Security had meant retirement benefits at age 65 and payments to widows and orphans. The House bill would have lowered the age at which women could begin collecting benefits to 62, but more significantly, it provided for the payment of benefits to totally disabled persons of both sexes at the age of 50, a provision that would transform Social Security from a retirement and survivor's benefit plan into a vehicle for much broader social welfare programs, including the program that was the long-time dream of liberals and labor and the long-time nightmare of many doctors. Social Security financed federal health insurance. Seeing the House bill as the thin end of the wedge for socialized medicine, the doctor's lobby, the immensely powerful American Medical Association, AMA, mobilized against it, confident of success. Annoying though the House action may have been, there was still that firmer body that had been created to stand against radical innovations. And thanks in part to its majority leader, the Senate had indeed stood firm in 1955. With Johnson declining to fight for the House bill, it had never even reached the Senate floor that year. By the time it came up in 1956, therefore, the AMA would have had over a year to pressure fence-sitting senators, particularly those facing re-election that year, one account noted. Johnson's program with the heart had mentioned Social Security, but mainly only to support the lower age requirement for women. It did not even mention disability benefits. Now, however, it was 1956, a presidential election year. Johnson decided to support the House bill because, as he told Democratic senators, it clearly differentiated them from Republicans. It was time to mend fences with labor, and this was the quickest way. "I happen to believe passionately in Social Security," he wrote AFL-CIO President George Meany. "I went through the Depression and saw what it did to our older people. A country that is as great as ours does little enough for them." The floor debate on the measure went on for 4 days in July, and for 4 days the count on Johnson's tally sheet seesawed back and forth. "The administration really put on the heat to defeat that bill," George Reedy says. "We'd wake up in the morning with about a 10-vote margin, and by 2 or 3 in the afternoon it would have dropped to about 3, and then it would shrink to 1. For 4 days, Johnson held the Senate in session. He had, he wrote Meany on July 19th, spent about 12 hours a day on the Senate floor for the last 4 or 5 days. The vote was going to be very close, but Johnson had quietly obtained leverage over 2 senators on whom Eisenhower was counting. Conservative Republicans were, of course, opposed to enlarging the scope of Social Security, and the further to the right they were, the more adamant their opposition. Among the furthest right, however, was Molly Malone, and the Nevada senator also had a bill up for consideration in 1956. A guarantee of at least $69 million in federal purchases from Nevada's tungsten mines, which was a blatantly unjustified giveaway of the public's money to an already wealthy special interest. Little attention was being paid to the proposed guarantee, which was, after all, a rather minor item in the overall federal budget. Both the Eisenhower administration and the Republican senatorial leadership opposed it, and most of those senators aware of it, even conservatives, were planning to vote against it. Liberals, of course, opposed it on principle. Since the tungsten interests were a major force in Nevada politics, without passage of the bill, Malone had little hope of re-election. But there seemed no way for him to get the necessary votes. Lyndon Johnson told Malone he would get him the votes, as many votes as were needed, in return for just 1 vote. Malone's vote in favor of the Social Security Disability Amendment. Malone agreed to the bargain. When the tungsten bill came up for a vote on June 18th, only 4 Republicans voted for it. But so did 28 Democrats, including liberals like Humphrey, Lehman, Kennedy, and Green, who would normally have voted against it. Johnson had offered them no explanation for his request that they vote for Malone's bill, simply asking them to support the leadership on the matter. "Few, if any, Democrats connected tungsten with the Social Security bill," Evans and Novak were to report. They were frankly puzzled, but the amount involved was small, and if the leader needed help, they were willing to give it to him. With little more than half the Senate voting, the bill passed by a 32-22 margin. Then, on July 17th, the Social Security bill came up for a vote. Malone, who had given no hint of his intentions to anyone but Johnson, was anxious not to be importuned face-to-face with earnest arguments by his own leader, Noland, who of course assumed his vote would be no. As Evans and Novak reported, he stayed in the cloakroom, appearing only momentarily to call his "I" vote for the disability amendment, then fairly ran out of the chamber, disappearing before Noland could get a crack at him. Malone's vote made the count on Social Security 46-46. The proposal would fail on a tie. Johnson needed 1 more vote. That vote belonged to Earl Clements. Of all the senators loyal to Lyndon Johnson in the way Lyndon Johnson wanted men loyal, none was more loyal, dog loyal, than the Kentucky senator who was willing to do anything for the leader. Clements was well aware by now that his re-election campaign against Thruston Morton, Assistant Secretary of State, was, in George Smathers's words, in serious trouble. He had not dared to oppose the doctors, whose opinions carried great weight with the unsophisticated voters in the rural Kentucky counties that were his stronghold, and had flatly promised the AMA that he would vote against the disability amendment. "Bob, I'm not with you on this bill," he had told the UAW's Oliver, Labor's chief representative on the issue. "I gave a commitment back home that I would vote against this bill." When Oliver started to protest, Clements cut him off. "I can't do it. I made a commitment." But the doctor's support was not all Clements needed against the well-financed Morton. He needed cash, campaign financing on a scale far beyond what Kentucky would provide. Johnson had already provided some from Texas and had promised Clements there would be more. Now, some weeks before the vote on the disability amendment, he told Clements he could have as much as he needed. But he said he might need something, too, Clements's vote in favor of the disability amendment. He didn't think he would need his vote, Lyndon Johnson said. The amendment was probably going to be defeated overwhelmingly, he said. But if it turned out that he did need Clements's vote, Johnson said, he wanted to know that he had it. Clements could vote against the amendment at first, Johnson said, but if the decision came down to one vote, Clements would have to change his vote on the amendment from nay to aye. Clements told Johnson that breaking his word to the doctors might cost him the election, and Johnson was aware of that. Johnson fully recognized that this would subject Clements to the full wrath of the doctors' lobby, Evans and Novak were to write. But Johnson refused to be influenced by this consideration, and Clements had no choice. He had to have the cash. Reluctantly, he agreed that if Johnson needed his vote, he would have it. And now, as the roll call proceeded on the Senate floor, Johnson ordered Clements to stay close to hand. The bald old pro was seated right next to Johnson, and sweat was coming off his head, Bobby Baker recalls. He was down there just hoping and praying that his vote would not be needed. But it was. Johnson told him to change it, and he changed it. And, as Baker says, we won by Clements's vote. Johnson provided what he had promised. He sent Booth Mooney to Clements's campaign headquarters in Louisville to provide speechwriting and public relations expertise, and more pragmatic assistance as well. He arranged, through me on a small scale and through Bobby Baker on a much larger scale, for financial assistance to be pumped into Kentucky, Mooney was to write. I remember Bobby Baker came down there one weekend with a suitcase just stuffed with currency for the Clements campaign. I think it was about $60,000, which was a good deal then. But the money couldn't offset that aye. Clements lost to Morton. The margin was less than 5,000 votes. No doubt about it, his vote on the disability provision defeated him, Evans and Novak wrote. The vote he cast in the Senate, to accommodate Johnson, infuriated the doctors and resulted in their organized opposition to his re-election, Mooney says. Even to someone as imbued with the pragmatism of politics as was Bobby Baker, this episode was something special. Senator Clements had made a commitment to Senator Johnson that although it would destroy him politically, which it did, if he broke his word, which he did, that he would vote with us, Baker says. Of all the votes that I've ever seen that was mean and cruel and defeated a man, it was that vote by Senator Clements to liberalize Social Security, contrary to his commitment to the doctors' lobby in Kentucky. Senators mutually recognize the primary natural law of political survival. Not this senator, not Lyndon Johnson. Kennedy would finally say he was sorry they couldn't agree, but he understood. If understanding stood in the way of Lyndon Johnson's aims, he wouldn't understand, would refuse to understand. He got the vote he needed from a senator, even though that vote cost the other senator, a senator dog loyal to him, his career. Baker, as always, was to try to excuse Johnson. Johnson tried to make up for Clements's defeat, he says. He made him campaign director of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Johnson felt bad about that one vote the rest of his life because he destroyed a man's political career. Johnson did indeed appoint Clements to the campaign committee post in 1957. In 1959, Clements resigned to become Kentucky's state highway commissioner and to work in Johnson's presidential campaign. He resigned the highway job within a few months at the age of 63 and never again held a position in government. After a brief stint with the Democratic National Committee in 1960, he became a consultant to the American Merchant Marine Institute and then a lobbyist for tobacco companies. Baker's view that Johnson felt bad does not jibe with the view of other Johnson aides and allies, including Booth Mooney, who over the years had sat in on many meetings between the two senators and who had been sure that Johnson truly loved Clements. When a saddened Mooney returned to Washington after Clements's defeat, he had expected Johnson to be sad too, at least a little sad, but Johnson simply congratulated Mooney on his work in Clements's campaign. And when I pointed out that obviously I had fallen short of attaining the hoped-for goal, Johnson said airily, "You shouldn't feel that way. Look at it this way. Your man ran way ahead of the national ticket. You did everything anybody could have done." Sometimes, Mooney wrote, Lyndon Johnson could be downright surprising. The senator's approval by a 47-45 vote of the Disability Amendment to the Social Security Act showed Lyndon Johnson's power at, in the case of Molly Malone, its most subtle, and at, in the case of Earl Clements, its most raw. And that approval showed also the extent of his power, documented again that the Senate, a body designed so that it would never have a master, had a master now. But the Senate was not what Lyndon Johnson wanted. It was only a step on the ladder to the goal, the only goal of which he dreamed. So he had at last to come to grips with his great dilemma, which was also America's great dilemma, the plight of 16 million Americans whose skins were black. Part 5. The Great Cause. Chapter 30. The Rising Tide. If an American citizen of African descent, a Negro, to use the term then in common usage, wanted to register to vote in Bullock County, Alabama, during the 1950s, he had to register under what the county's board of registrars called the voucher system. He was required to bring with him a supporting witness, called by the board a voucher, to attest to his character, morals, and general fitness to be a voter. But only Bullock County residents who were already registered voters were eligible to be supporting witnesses, and no witness could vouch for more than 3 persons during each 4-year term of the board. And since, by inviolate Bullock County custom, no white person would ever vouch for a Negro, eligible vouchers for Bullock Negroes were in rather short supply. For out of the county's 11,000 Negro residents, exactly 5 were registered voters. This meant, of course, that no more than 15 Negroes could be registered during any 4-year period, but even this number was apparently more than the board was disposed to allow, as a small group of Negroes, perhaps a half dozen, learned, when on January 18, 1954, they showed up at the board's office in the Bullock County Courthouse in Union Springs with their supporting witnesses. "What's your trouble?" Board Chairman S.B. Wilson asked them brusquely, and when one of them, Aaron Sellers, a 40-year-old farmer, replied that they were there to register, Wilson said, "Well, we're busy today. You all come back tomorrow." They returned the next day. Wilson and his fellow board members let them sit there for an hour, until finally another white man, Alan B. Tucker, who, as a federal judge was to note, was not connected with the board in any official capacity, came over to them and asked the same question, "What's your trouble?" Sellers, speaking for the group, said, "We were here yesterday and the chairman told us to come back today." Tucker asked them why they wanted to vote. Sellers said something to the effect that they wanted to vote because they were citizens, and Tucker said, "You all are citizens already. You pay taxes, don't you? If I were you, I would go back home." And when they didn't take his advice but remained sitting, the board continuing to ignore them, for perhaps another half hour, the veneer of civility, thin though it was, disappeared entirely. Returning to the room, Tucker stood over the Negroes and said in a low, threatening voice, "I thought I told you to get the hell out of here." The Negroes were all aware not only of incidents of violence against members of their race who had defied white wishes, but of other forms of intimidation as well. The white people in the town kept a list of the names of who was trying to vote, and they kept the list in their pockets for ready reference, Sellers would recall. There were many ways in which that list could be used. Word had been passed that the banks were organizing and might stop lending colored people money, he says. The county's impoverished Negro farmers would shortly, in March or April, need crop loans, money to buy seed and fertilizer to plant their cotton and peanut crops. And, as Sellers says, you had to have a little to live on, too, you know, until the crops were harvested in October. Tucker's threat was effective. We were all somewhat afraid, Sellers says. We got up and left. When he decided to make another attempt on February 1st, he was able to persuade only three men to come with him. Not that it made much difference. Their approach to the courthouse had been noted, and this time when they walked up the stairs and knocked on the door to the Board of Registrar's office, there was no reply. And when Sellers finally worked up the nerve to open the door, the room was empty. Encountering a white courthouse clerk in a corridor, the four Negroes asked where the board was meeting, and the clerk, a smirk on his face, said he didn't know. Afraid to go looking in every office, the Negroes finally left the courthouse and stood outside, waiting for the registrars to come out and go to lunch. When they returned, they followed them to the unmarked office in the basement in which they had been meeting. But although all three members of the board went into the room, when Sellers knocked on the door, only Wilson appeared, stepping through the door and closing it quickly behind him. And when Sellers told him that he and his friends wanted to register, Wilson, as Sellers was to recall, told us he couldn't register us because he was alone and the law required two at least to be present. They knew now that the board was not going to allow them to register, Sellers was to say, so we didn't go back any more. Instead, they decided to go to law to sue the Board of Registrars for denying them the chance to vote. We were citizens. We knew the law said citizens could vote, Sellers was to say. We thought we would win. They found an attorney, Arthur D. Scholes of Birmingham, one of the handful of black lawyers in Alabama, who was willing to represent them, and Scholes brought suit in federal district court in Montgomery, the state capital, asking for a declaratory judgment that the board had discriminated against them, and for an injunction prohibiting the board from such discrimination and ordering it to use the same criteria for registering Negroes as it did for whites. The Federal Bureau of Investigation had no difficulty in confirming their story. No sooner had an FBI agent looking for witnesses entered a pool hall in Union Springs and pulled out his badge than Tucker told him proudly, "I just run off a bunch of niggers who were trying to vote." But then, having gone to the law, they found out there was no law that could help them. The district court judge, Charles Kennemer, ruled in ringing words that their cause was just. The board's actions, whenever the plaintiffs appeared before them, amounted to discrimination solely because the plaintiffs were members of the Negro race, he wrote. The supreme law of this republic is that no voter can be discriminated against. Therefore, let no board of registrars try to devise any scheme or artifice to do otherwise. The words didn't mean much, however, as even the judge had to admit. By the time he issued his ruling, it was irrelevant. While the trial was still going on, the three members of the board simply resigned. And in his ruling, Kennemer had to admit that, by virtue of their resignations, the defendants are now beyond the veil of an injunctive directive from this court. There was no point in ordering them to register Negroes. They couldn't register Negroes any longer. No one in Bullock County could register Negroes. In his ruling, the judge promised that the court will grant injunctive relief in the event these defendants again become members of the board. The defendants did not again become members of the board. They stayed resigned until their terms expired in 1956. During this time, their posts remained unfilled. Vacancies were supposed to be filled by a state agency, but the state agency didn't fill the vacancies for more than 2 years. And Aaron Sellers and his friends were told that there was no law that could compel the state to fill them. And when, in 1957, a new, different board of registrars was appointed, and Sellers and his friends returned, hoping for a better result, they found the board office again empty. "We couldn't find out where the board were," he says. And they realized they would have to begin the same laborious legal proceeding all over again, with, almost certainly, the same result at the end of it. All across the South, the 11 states of the old Confederacy that stretched in a great crescent from the Atlantic Ocean to the plains of West Texas, black American citizens being discriminated against, not only in voting, but in housing, in employment, in virtually every aspect of life, were trying during the 1950s to turn to the law so that they could enjoy the same rights as white Americans. And all across the South, black Americans were finding what the blacks of Bullock County had found, that there was no law that could help them. Once, long before, for a brief period, there had been such laws. Some had been woven into the fabric of the Constitution that was America's highest law. The three great Civil War amendments to the Constitution had been passed to give force to the concept of the equality of all men which had been proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence, but which had then, in submission to the slaveholding South, been omitted from the Constitution itself. The 13th Article, in addition to and amendment of the Constitution, outlawed the institution of slavery. The 14th made former slaves citizens, full citizens entitled to due process of law, to the equal protection of the laws, to all the rights, the sacred privileges and immunities of citizens. The 15th made specific that among the rights of these new citizens was the right to vote, the right on which all other rights rest in a democracy in which governmental powers were derived from the consent of the governed. The right of citizens to vote shall not be denied or abridged by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, the 15th Amendment proclaimed. Each of the amendments or articles had an identical final clause. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. And in the decade immediately after the terrible war, a vengeful Congress determined to reconstruct the South had exercised that power, accepted that responsibility, enacting specific national statutes to give teeth to those guarantees. In 1866, it passed the first Civil Rights Act, which enumerated in provisions both detailed and sweeping the civil rights, the specific rights, privileges, and immunities of citizens, which were not to be left to the varying whims of states, but were to be protected by the sovereign central government. In 1867, it passed the first Reconstruction Act, which not only disbanded the governments of the rebel states, but carved the South into 5 military districts subject to martial law to ensure that the black man's right to vote would be backed by federal bayonets. And when the South thereupon erupted in rage, and the men of the old Confederacy donned the hoods of the Klan and rode out in the thousands to beat and maim and kill, Congress passed more laws, stiff election enforcement bills, that prohibited the use of force or intimidation, or of bribery or fraud, to deter citizens from voting because of their race, and that ensured as well that, if necessary, those bayonets would be used. And in 1875 it enacted another Civil Rights Act, one that sought to guarantee Negroes the right to serve on juries, and that also sought to free them from discrimination in the daily round of life, guaranteeing their rights to the full and equal enjoyment of the accommodations of inns, of theaters and other places of public amusement, and of public facilities and public conveyances of every type. The Civil Rights Act of 1875 was the high point and the end point of the passage of such laws, however.
End of Disc 29.